How long have we got, Michael?
I think we've got plenty of time, Kieran.
Plenty of time, yeah.
I'd say probably half an hour. Is that good?
Okay.
Yeah. So to make sure you project, yeah?
Yeah. Well, I'll obviously pass it out to the audience pretty quickly, but where's a good place to start? Maybe at the end, actually, where the mention of Walter Benjamin at the end. And I remember when I spoke to you a long time ago about this film, you talked about how Walter Benjamin influenced this one, but has also been an influence on other of your films as well. Maybe that's a good route into this film.
Sure. Well, when I was working as a pushcart vendor, I had a lot of opportunity to look very closely at money, paper money, because I handled it all day, and I was often at loss for something to do. So I would scrutinize the bills, and it was somewhere in the early middle stages of starting this project that I came across a passage by Walter Benjamin, or Benjamin, however you prefer, in which he said that somebody should do a study, a close-up study of the banknote and something along the lines of that there in the sheaves of wheat and the other symbols were the portals to hell. And I just thought, wow, what a wild thing for a man to say. So I became interested in Walter Benjamin really because of that quote. And then I became quite fond of him. How many of you have read Walter Benjamin or at least have a sense of who he was? That's pretty good. When I was in university, we were forced to read Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, which is kind of the standard introduction and sometimes the stopping place. And it is a very prescient essay. But Benjamin, to me, among the many things that he was, one of them being hard to pin down, was a great wanderer and a walker and someone who studied cities in their nooks and crannies and sort of innately understood that cities and memory were kind of parallel labyrinths in which we could get lost, as I just did on my way here, and as I am generally wont to do in a city, even one that I know pretty well, but I don't know London very well. So anyway, Benjamin, what can I say? I love the man. You know, he's also quite well known for his use of the idea of the flaneur. But even that is something that's kind of a complicated matter, because as he often did, he took a notion and introduced it, and it becomes sort of hard to know whether he thinks it's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, the flaneur is something that Walter Benjamin sees as a human byproduct of this coming monster of capitalism. And as that changes the world, as it changes cities, as it changes how we experience the street, he sees that there will be kind of types of people that will be born into the world dealing with things like shops and shopping malls. And the flaneur is a wanderer in the city, but also someone who has a lot of time on their hands, may be a kind of an idler, but might also be a kind of sort of student of the public space. How's that for a digressionary ramble?
Yeah, okay. Well, talk a little bit about time then in the context of this film, because, I mean, it's 20 years ago since you made this film, isn't it? And I kind of suspect that, you know, in New York it looks very different now. I mean, you talk a little bit about the frantic pace of change even at that time, but
yeah.
That's kind of picked up even more since then.
Yeah, well, the city is almost unrecognizable from that one in some regards. I mean, I would never have imagined that it would have changed as much as it has. I'm sure you could say the same for London, really, comparing London of that time to London now. And a lot of that change is par for the course in a large city, but a lot of it is par for a kind of relentless corporatized homogenization that has taken over many, many of our cities. And so the New York of what we would call the mom and pop business, the corner store, the non-chain coffee shop, the many of those things are gone or endangered. Some of them are still there. But it greatly changes the fabric of the city when they disappear. And one of the things that I was doing was I was, because of my brief time as a pushcart vendor, I became kind of fascinated by the street level economy, which is often invisible to us if we're not involved in it. And so parked at my pushcart every day, you know, next to me was, as I discussed, you know, somebody selling things, souvenirs and other items, other kinds of food vendors. And then also there came, you know, familiarity with the roots of local police, local buses, local passerby who would come by each day. And it all was a kind of revelation in a way to me, because I, you know, kind of studied things like capitalism in passing, having not had a particularly, I didn't go to grad school and I wasn't very kind of, I didn't really study things like cities or certainly, you know, economics or critical theory, any of that when I was in university, but, you know, I certainly knew the term. And then I found that, well, you know, this is it on this level. I mean, this is what capitalism is like for a lot of people who actually live in it, not as an abstraction or a kind of constant note in academic lectures, but as just an actuality, a kind of weather. And so that fascinated me, to think of doing a project in which I was kind of investigating capitalism through the most commonplace day-to-day experiences. And so I don't know how I got quite onto that. We can add jet lag to the mix, ladies and gentlemen. Jet lag. But it
took you 8 years to make, is that right, this film?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I started shooting, I often work in a kind of as a kind of collector, where I might shoot for years without really knowing that I'm on a particular project. So I made one film when I first arrived in New York, in which I think I was very much looking kind of up and around in a kind of awe at a city, which was quite extraordinary to me. And so that initial tendency to sort of look up, as a few years, couple of years went by, and then I thought about this job, I sort of made the kind of vague decision to do a film about looking down, where I was really mostly concerned with the kind of the sidewalk and the gutter and the small shops and basically the margins and the periphery, and taking on the city through this kind of microcosmic view, rather than thinking in terms of the landmarks or the kind of bigger known entities. So I started to shoot. I was shooting silent Super 8 in a cartridge that runs about 2.5 to 3 minutes, and I was at the time quite obsessed with Super 8 and carrying a camera in my pocket as much as I could, and I started to gather material, but without really knowing what the project would be. And I did that for 2 or 3 years. You know, occasionally getting flashes of where I was headed, but really in a way kind of obsessively gathering certain kinds of evidence, but really not knowing how I might make use of it. And so it was a very, by the fifth, sixth, and then seventh year, it became quite overwhelming in a way. It was kind of obsessive, and it, in a way, I felt like it was kind of a bit of a dark cloud. But I liked it, too. And there were just certain things that I would shoot as a matter of course. And eventually I had quite a collection of them, and then the film kind of, in a way, sort of made itself.
And when did you come up with this idea then of the book, the lost book?
One thing is that, you know, there's some debate about what is true here and what isn't. And in the realm of documentary and essay film, you know, I think there's a particular kind of genre of hybrid work which has a certain large element of documentary actuality, but also a degree of perhaps autobiography or diary, personal aspects which may or may not, it isn't necessarily important that they be 100% accurate or truthful. And so, you know, there are some things that I've always refused to discuss really about the film, because in a way I think it's unimportant to discuss them, because it's not what the film is there for, you know? So, you know, I mean, there are a few things that I've confessed. I didn't sell peanuts, I sold Italian ices. And I wasn't uptown, I was downtown. So, you know, things shift around a bit. And the book is a kind of, you know, in some regards, it may be real. I've certainly seen things quite like it.
They fell off again.
Sorry about that. I'm not doing very well here. For a film technician myself, striking out. Okay, let's see. It's the clip. It's the weakness of the clip, not the weakness of the clipper.
Can you put it through a button or something?
Yeah. Okay, how's that?
It's great.
Good? Good. All right. So where were we? Lies, yes. I should have used that opportunity to drop the subject altogether. Move right along. Suffice to say, you know, one thing that I had studied a little bit in university was Hitchcock and this notion of the MacGuffin, where he would have an object or an item that everybody was like hunting for in the course of the movie, but it really didn't matter at all. I mean, it's like the lost suitcase or the something, and it was just a way for him to get at certain things. And I thought, you know, I don't have any interest in discussing with people the accuracy of this story or this documentary. What I'm interested in is having people be given certain ways to experience cities or their own lives through certain lenses, through certain possibilities. And so to me, the book, you know, it could be 100% real, but I wouldn't tell you even if it was, because it doesn't, that's not what it's about, you know? So I think that's an interesting aspect of the essay is to talk about one thing as a way of getting at something else, you know.
She said the book chimes so much with all the kind of text. I mean, it's like the city becomes a text in the film to some extent. I mean, you're focusing a lot on objects, but also signage and kind of these little scraps of paper with strange messages on.
I loved that idea of the palimpsest, you know, of the kind of bit of something underneath something else. And also, I mean, one thing that's, I think, interesting that I've noted over the years is detected movement. Uh-oh. I'm going to keep... No, I get it. I understand the problem now, so I can just keep fiddling with it to get it right. So, we have it. I'll stop talking while I actually do get it right, so it's not just the sound of terrible crunching on the... Okay. I'll try again. I'll try to limit my movements. Where was I?
The palimpsest.
Palimpsest, yeah. So, one thing I've noticed over the years is, this project was made really in a time when the computer was not anywhere near as commonplace as it became even within a couple of years of the film. And nor was certainly that applied to things like Photoshop and fonts, and therefore what we have experienced as one of the many great and terrible things that the computer and the digital world have done to us is we have very little of the handwritten signage that one used to find as a matter of course, particularly coming from people who really couldn't do anything else. But now almost anybody can just, type into a computer, even if it's at a library, and then print out a kind of standardized looking thing in various preset fonts. So it's done a great deal of damage for those of us who rather enjoy the personal stamp of the of the street missive. It's really a shame, Like when I first came to London, those very, we don't have the tradition of the perverse, naughty question mark, call so-and-so. We don't really have that in the U.S. in the same way. So it's always been, quite amusing to me to step into a payphone thing in London. And when I first came to London, those were mostly handwritten and then Xeroxed. Mm. And, now they're really flashy with clip art and, digitally enhanced photos of the spanker or whatever it is. And it's really kind of gone downhill. It's just not that interesting to see these anymore. Mm. Anyway.
So. Questions?
Yes. Yeah.
I was just going to say, there's a few things I want to say to you, actually. Number one, you must know, but I've always thought about Lost Book Band and the relationship to Joseph Mitchell's Joggled Secrets. Do you know about that?
Yeah, I've read little bits and pieces of Mitchell, and I kind of, revere him from an ignorant distance, but I've never read, the book,
Yeah, okay, well, maybe, yeah.
But I should. Yeah. I've always meant to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is, because that's about, that. In a way, there's a parallel story. His stories are about New York, he's a journalist, and there's definitely a blurring of fiction and reality going on in those stories.
Right, but he also, as far as I know, was never able to finish whatever the...
Yeah, well, that's it. He was never able to finish Joe Gould was never able to finish the book, his book.
The magnum opus. Yeah,
and then it's, it's about Joe Gould's secret not really being truth either. So
right,
that's
right.
Why it's
well, I should read that, but yeah. I got enough of it to get that
yeah,
whiff
Yeah, but maybe
of
that's, I mean, that's it. I like the fact that you've never read it, actually. Right. I think that's great, because I like the fact that there's parallel thinking
well,
going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, and then
there.
Back
and
to...
parallel things as well.
Yeah, and then, back to Walter Benjamin. I mean, one of the things that greatly, that just, kind of... breaks everybody's heart, but it's also very powerful in its way, is that the Arcades Project is in some ways a lost thing. I mean, we will never know exactly what he wanted it to be. They found that this was kind of his great work, that he a project that he embarked on, sort of studying the arcades in Paris as a kind of museum and metaphor and a sort of stepping off place for a great study of the modern world, particularly capitalism, and particularly sort of prefiguring the shopping mall. So Benjamin works on the Arcades Project for well more than 10 years, really. And then, you know, he is beleaguered and broke and in exile and moving from place to place, and eventually, you know, dies at the Spanish border trying to escape capture by the authorities and being turned into the Nazis. And much is lost, including a large notebook, a large suitcase that he was sort of dragging laboriously with him through rough terrain and not in good health. And, you know, they've done a remarkable job of kind of gathering the bits and pieces and big blocks of the Arcades project that were kind of hidden here and there, including in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. But it still has this sort of thing of that he was never able to finish it, and we will never know exactly what it is. And I think that in a way, like, I think many essay filmmakers in particular, you know, I would think of, well, Marker, Patrick Keeler, you know, people kind of working around this idea of a sort of puzzles and unsolvable gatherings of material that really are not ever going to be resolved, and that becomes really their magic in a way.
The arcade thing as well. I was thinking that the Arcades is above, but yours is below.
Yeah,
so
that's true. But the Arcades, you know, to me, it reminded me of. Well, I mean, one of the things about the. Oh, do it again. I've got to stop it. I'm going to hold it in my hand. That I can manage. Sorry. How's that now? Good? All right, I'm going to hold it like a little microphone. The Arcades project, the covered Arcades of Paris, a lot of them were already in decay when he was writing about them and wandering through them and thinking about them. And so they were kind of, you know, now some of those very arcades still exist, but they're very high end and kind of cleaned up. He saw them full of dust covered objects, much as when I was doing Lost Book Found, 14th Street was a corridor of discount stores and odd lot stores, they call them, and there was a lot of, you know, kind of dust covered, you know, bits and pieces of things, and so that the city also becomes a kind of museum of its own prehistory, and anyway, and shall we get to a few more? I don't know how long I've rambled. I see the hook. The hook.
Yeah, I have the hook.
Okay. All right, I'm going to get concise now. I'm going to get focused.
I just
wanted
to ask whether you have any cinematic forebears, influences, movies of the city that you had in...
Yeah, I mean, I have countless, but I didn't really, since I have to say, I went to a university which had no documentary, didn't teach documentary at all, and had absolutely no regard for so-called experimental or avant-garde cinema. So the cinema that I had really kind of studied in any kind of depth was actually like classical Hollywood cinema, which did me no good whatsoever. And in terms of what I ended up doing or wanting to do, I did have the great fortune to stumble on the works of Jean Vigo and to see first Zero for Conduct, then La Talante, and eventually Apropos de Nice, which is his first film and one of the great essay films ever made, in which he is studying a city and really kind of discovering how to make it as he goes. And it's a combination of city symphony and scathing critique of the kind of the decadence of this seaside resort, and it's just many things, and it's still incredibly wonderful. So Vigo was very important to me. I had the opportunity to see Man with a Movie Camera. So Vertov was definitely a key point, but I was actually quite ignorant of many things at the time when I was making this. Like, I certainly hadn't seen much of, or maybe barely any Chris Marker, certainly hadn't seen Sans Soleil at the time that I made this. And so it was really much later that I felt like, oh, you know, you're part of a tradition that would include Joris Evans and Humphrey Jennings. You know, I mean, not to compare myself to those people, but I eventually came to really love Jennings and others who found their way to a form that was at once city portrait, but also deeply personal, also very musical, and in regards to documentary, remarkably open. So that's something that I had, you know, became more and more aware of over the years.
It's just that when I was watching the movie, it suddenly strangely reminded me of Zorn's Lemma.
Which I didn't know. I still haven't seen it, but I know, you know.
But it suddenly made me think that this is not just an avant-garde film and a conceptual film. It's a city film. So putting right. your movie with that threw some light back on.
Right. Well, one thing I love about him, yeah. Hollis Frampton, that's right? Yeah, Hollis Frampton. I love the film Nostalgia. But one of the great things about it is that there's this offset between what you see and what you hear, so that it's always slipped. And I do that all the time mm-hmm. in Lost Book Found, where sometimes it's right spot on where the narrator is talking about something that you see, but often he's talking about something that you've either seen down the road back a little bit or you're going to see up ahead. Mm-hmm. And it's a slippage that I sort of, I think, discovered by instinct. And I still couldn't really exactly tell you why it works, but there's something that I found very important about it in my work that very much
and
relates.
You're right. Actually, Nostalgia is probably more relevant because it is a portrait of New York as well as a portrait of the man himself.
Mm. Any last?
Maybe one more question?
Yes, I got one.
Yeah.
Because you work for very long periods and you don't quite know where you're going with the project, how do you store your collection?
It's
of
a nightmare. It's a terrible catastrophe. And I understand, unfortunately, that I don't know if what you saw looked all that good, and that's because of part of this terrible problem of shifting formats and trying to bring outdated and you know, kind of dinosaur, sometimes wonderful analog formats into the modern world. So I don't know what you were. Is the projectionist around? What were we?
Sebastian's here. Yeah, it was the beta cam.
It was a beta cam. Well, it shouldn't have looked so bad. But the problem is just that we are in a digital HD universe, and that stuff can look great, and everything else is frequently really having a hard time because the gear itself is usually set up now for, you know, HD digital material, and not other formats. But anyway, I have an archive, every shelf full, up to the ceiling. I wish I could say I knew what was in it. I did at some points. I don't anymore. Countless rolls of Super 8, hundreds and hundreds of, you know, hundreds of rolls of 16 millimeter, hundreds, if not maybe 1,000 rolls of Super 8, plus now, you know, rotting hard drives, you know, which add to that problem in a whole new and terrifying way. So the
do you live with your collection, or do you have it in
no,
a studio?
No, I pay an ungodly rental on a storage room because I've always been terrified of having it all go up in flames, and I thought it's less likely to happen in a storage room where at least, you know, nobody's cooking on a hot plate. So, you know, actually somebody probably is, but, you know, not so many people. So it's a constant weight and dilemma. If you're an incredibly wealthy archivist benefactor, please see me after the after the Q&A.
Are you still? What can I just ask? No, are you still working the material, your collection? I mean, are you sifting
absolutely.
And reworking?
Yeah, well, that's why. I mean, it would all be a lot easier if I could just finish a project and then retire it to some cheaper storage room and seal the boxes and say that's done with. But no, I don't. I constantly remember, oh yeah, you know, in 1989 you got that shot of the Longacre building, and that's going to be very useful, you know, 10 years from now when you finish the 27-year long Times Square 42nd Street project. So, you know, I have to work from the archive, and quite often the projects unfold over the course of 7 or 8 or 10 years, and that's just the way it is.